Good morning. We have gathered for the purpose this morning of meeting with God and to bring Him our worship. We've also come for the purpose of hearing from Him. So I'd ask you if you would start with me. Instead of in the book of Esther, we're going to begin in Psalm chapter 40. Psalm 40, verse 4. Psalm 40, verse 4 says, "Blessed is the man who makes the Lord his trust, who does not turn to the proud, to those who go astray after a lie." Be helpful to keep that open as we think about this a little bit. In that verse, the proud, and we're going to be looking at Haman in the book of Esther today, seeing him to be a man who is consumed by pride. The pride that we're talking about here, and in that verse in Psalm 40, verse 4, the proud are likened to those who go astray after something. They're searching for something, and unfortunately what they find is a lie. And this indicates that there are two paths that a person can be on. Either they are trusting in God, or they are in that way of the proud. We're looking today at two different paths that a person can be living on, seeking to trust God in their life, or seeking this other way, the way of the proud. The lie that the proud go after in that verse, I think if we tried to define that, we would say that they are looking after the blessing to be found in certain things other than God, in things like wealth and in power and in fame. And so they pursue that rather than this contrast. Well, the contrast then in the verse itself makes it clear that the blessing is to be had in only to be had by those who trust in the Lord. So there's two pathways. And that means that you this morning, you are walking in one of those two pathways. Either you are one who daily is seeking to put your trust in God for the blessing, or you are turning to the proud way. In pride, you're seeking a different way, the way that boasts independence from God, the way that promises what it cannot produce. And that's why it's called you're seeking after a lie. It's not going to provide what you are after. Another Psalm 10, if you go back a little bit, in verse 4 says, "In the pride of his face, the wicked does not seek him. All of his thoughts are, there is no God." A description of the thoughts of the proud person. The story of the wicked man Haman that we're going to look at in chapter 6 of Esther today is a lesson in how the pride of man collides head on with the sovereignty of God. Man and his pride, how that really clashes with what and who God is. We said it not long ago in a previous message, but God hates pride. He hates it. We don't think all that often of things that God hates. We always like to think of God as a God of love, and yet God hates pride. We quoted from the list from Proverbs chapter 7 of the things that the Lord hates. Let me read that for you one more time. Think about how Haman is characterized by these things in this list. In Proverbs 6, verses 16 to 19, "There are six things that the Lord hates, seven that are an abomination to him. It begins with haughty eyes, a lying tongue, hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked plans." And we can go on. It talks about feet that run to evil quickly, a false witness who breathes out lies, and one who sows discord among brothers. But those characterize so many times there Haman. He's filled with pride. He's a hater. He schemes evil plans. He's a murderous man. Well, that sets the stage for a huge clash with a God who is holy, a God who is one who is sovereign over all things. This Haman turned to the proud, to those who go astray after a lie. And we read of that clash between man's pride and God's sovereignty in Esther 6. So let's turn back now to Esther chapter 6. And let that Psalm 40 be a background for us now as we look at what happens to Haman. Esther chapter 6, beginning at verse 1. That night. What night? We've got to back up a little bit. What night are we talking about? Just in the previous verse, in verse 14, "His wife Zeresh and his friends said to him, 'Have a gallows built 75 feet high, and ask the king in the morning to have Mordecai hanged on it. Then go with the king to the dinner and be happy.' This suggestion delighted Haman, and he had the gallows built. That night, the king could not sleep, so he ordered the book of the Chronicles and record of his reign to be brought in and read to him. It was found recorded there that Mordecai had exposed Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's officers who guarded the doorway, who had conspired to assassinate King Xerxes. "What honor and recognition has Mordecai received for this?" the king asked. "Nothing has been done for him," his attendants answered. The king said, "Who's in the court?" Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the palace to speak to the king about hanging Mordecai on the gallows that he had erected for him. His attendants answered, "Haman is standing in the court." "Bring him in," the king ordered. And when Haman entered, the king asked him, "What should be done for the man the king delights to honor?" Now Haman thought to himself, "Who is there that the king would rather honor than me?" So he answered the king, "Well, for the man the king delights to honor, have them bring a royal robe the king has worn and a horse the king has ridden on, one with a royal crest placed on its head. Then let the robe and horse be entrusted to one of the king's most noble princes. Let them robe the man the king delights to honor and lead him on the horse through the city streets, proclaiming before him, 'This is what is done for the man the king delights to honor.'" "Go at once," the king commanded Haman. "Get the robe and the horse and do just as you have suggested for Mordecai, the Jew, who sits at the king's gate. Do not neglect anything that you have recommended." So Haman got the robe and the horse. He robed Mordecai and led him on horseback through the city streets, proclaiming before him, "This is what is done for the man the king delights to honor." Afterward, Mordecai returned to the king's gate, but Haman rushed home with his head covered in grief and told Zeresh, his wife, and all his friends everything that had happened to him. His advisors and his wife Zeresh said to him, "Since Mordecai, before whom your downfall has started, is of Jewish origin, you cannot stand against him. You will surely come to ruin." While they were still talking with him, the king's eunuchs arrived and hurried Haman away to the banquet Esther had prepared. In the middle of a story, when you come to something like that, this is where the story gets good. You're starting to really get involved in the story now. You can really see the antagonism that's been built up earlier on in the story now comes to a head. I want you to know that it would not be enough for us this morning as we sit in this place of worship to simply read about Haman, read about what happens to him, and say, "Yes, he was a bad man. He was a prideful man, and God hates pride, so he was punished as he should have been." That wouldn't be enough this morning. Because we are called to go beyond that, to understand that our old natures as character are characterized by the same exact pride that Haman had. Our flesh would even yet thrust us down this path of independence from God if it could. Our sin is all rooted. When we sin today, when we continue to go on in our sin, it is rooted in this same self pride and self-centeredness, an attitude of independence from God. And so we must hear the warning this morning: be on guard that you do not be like Haman. You do not fall into the traps into which Haman fell. And in order for us this morning to heed that warning and be careful about that, we need to understand how the typical pattern of falling into pride works. How is it developed in our heart? How is it that we become a proud person, really? We have to notice where the path of pride deviates from God's good path. We said that there are two paths: the paths of trusting in God, and then this proud path that leads to a lie. And so how does that path work? How do we deviate from God's path to go off that into that dangerous area? Well, let's look at Haman's pride and see how this works. The first step off the straight and narrow path that God intends for the believer is to begin basking in the genuine praise of others, but to begin to claim it for yourself. Genuine praise that is offered to you because maybe there's something praiseworthy, and yet you begin to claim that praise and that honor all for yourself. And what I mean by that is when somebody praises you for a legitimate accomplishment or something that is indeed a skill that you have, something that's good that you're doing, you begin to enjoy that praise just a bit too much. And you forget something. You forget that God is the one who gave it to you. You forget that God is the one who is worthy of praise alone. He is the one who has given the gift, and He enables you. Notice how Haman does this. If you go back to chapter 3, I'm going to track a little bit through the story here a little bit. Let's go back to chapter 3, verse 1. And watch how the king first honors Haman and commands that others bow down to him. You'll see that he honored Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, elevating him and giving him a seat of honor higher than that of all the other nobles. So he's been honored. He's been put in a position of authority. Now, a man ought to have an accurate evaluation of himself, and it's okay. It's actually okay to receive praise when it's due. But sometimes, in the course of our daily lives, people praise us in ways that go beyond really what is appropriate. As happens here when the king not only elevates him to this high position, but the king also does something else, and that's he commands people to bow down to Haman to show this praise. Well, Haman should have said to the king, "I really appreciate the sentiment, but I'm not comfortable with that. I'm certainly not one before whom people should bow down. That's something that's reserved for God. That's homage, and you want to give that only to God. God is worthy of praise. I thank you for putting me in the position where you have, and I'll do my best. But don't bow down to me." Instead, what does Haman do? He basks in the praise. And having already denied, really, God, the God of the Jews, he thought that whatever skills that he had that got him in this promotion from the king were innately his. They were something that he had developed, something that were his alone, rather than a gift from God. If God doesn't exist, you see, then who better for people to bow down to than me? In fact, I want people to bow down to me. And that's the first step, taking in the praise of others and yet claiming it as if it were your own, rather than acknowledging the God who gives you the ability to do what you have done. And that's only the first step. The second step goes farther off the path. And that is where you begin to feel slighted when people fail to praise you. When people don't acknowledge you, you begin to feel like, hey, they should have. And that happens here in chapter 3, verse 5, when Haman is incensed that Mordecai won't bow down to him. He won't do it. Gone now is any question of the appropriateness of whether a person ought to do such a thing, that you ought to receive homage of this kind from this fellow man. That's all gone now, you see. As pride has begun to get rooted in Haman's life, Haman now goes and expects that others will bow down to him, and that they should. When others disagree about that, it's the appropriateness of that, he becomes enraged. How dare you not bow down to me? It's not a very far leap from entertaining thoughts that you maybe deserve the praise that they're giving to begin believing that you deserve it and feeling hurt or offended when you don't get it. If one doesn't get off of that destructive path, it will inevitably lead to the third step, namely the use of manipulation to get other people to praise you, to beginning to manipulate or use power or get more power and get more praise. You see Haman demonstrating that in chapter 3, verses 9 and 10. He does something rather remarkable. Well, he's just been elevated to this second position in the kingdom. That's not good enough. He wants the power of the king. He wants to get the king's signet ring where he can begin to do what the king does. And so he pushes the king. He influences. He begins to manipulate the king so that he can get that ring. He can get that ability to make that kind of command. He's extremely bold. Pride is brazen at times. And we see Haman being extremely bold in asking for that which he had no business asking for. I imagine Haman became the kind of friend who was like a dripping faucet. It does seem like these guys are becoming friends, King Ahasuerus and Haman. But he's like a dripping faucet, always pressuring for something else. That's great, but can I have a little bit more power? Can I have a little bit more? I was interested to see that one writer I was reading suggested that it was this constant presence of Haman with the king. He's always there. You can hardly get rid of him. That led to Esther's not being able to see the king for 30 days. You notice that? A little while ago it said that Esther hadn't been with the king for 30 days. He hadn't called for her. He hadn't sought her out. Why? Because he's already got a companion who's just pushing all the time to be right there with the king, crowding out that relationship that the king has with his own wife. It's no wonder that the king was so glad to see her when she boldly approached him. But pride leads to manipulation of others and of circumstances so that we can get what we want. It's a dangerous path to be on because, once again, it particularly clashes with head-on with the sovereignty of God, with God's providential governing of things, how He rules and how He leads to events. Not content with God's governing, we try to manipulate things so that we can get more. More power, more influence, more money, more attention. But there's more. This leads deeper into beginning to have a distorted perspective of reality in general. That's the fourth step. You begin to have a distorted view of reality. You see this progression in chapter 5, verse 9, if you jump over there. Haman is invited to a banquet by the queen. What is Esther's intent in that banquet for Haman? Is it to honor him? Exactly the opposite. What Esther has intention, she has no intention whatsoever to honor Haman by inviting him to this party. And in reality, she's about to ask the king to rid himself of this uninvited friend who keeps pushing in, who had plotted a destruction not only of Esther, but of her whole people. And yet Haman takes this invitation as another indication that people are praising me. That's a distortion of reality. He goes home and he boasts this to his wife and his friends. What does he say to them? He says, I am the only person that Queen Esther invited to accompany the king to the banquet. You see, praise me, wife. Praise me, friends, because, you see, I've been praised elsewhere. I just want more. Praise me. It's all about me. Keep praising me. Pride, by definition, is thinking too much of yourself. And if pride is left to grow in the heart, then it progresses to a distortion, not only in the heart, but in the eyes. The prideful person does not see things as they really are. And this is what that list in Proverbs uses. It uses that phrase, haughty eyes, is one of the things the Lord hates. It doesn't call it pride, it's called haughty eyes. It's the same thing. It has to do with the distortion of one's perspective on things. Pride acts like a disease. In that left untreated, it progresses and progresses and progresses down this spiral. If a person does not stomp out pride in his life, then inevitably it will go on to the next step. And that is that one's happiness becomes absolutely dependent on the favorable opinion of other people. Note that one carefully. One's happiness becomes dependent on the favorable opinion of other people. If you continue down in chapter 5, verses 9 through 13, you see that Haman's happiness becomes intricately tied to the praises of men. I'm only happy when I'm being praised. If he had a day in which people praised him, what happens? He's ecstatic. Things are great. It doesn't last very long, though. He's happy and content for a moment. If he discovers for a moment that someone questions him or that someone is not giving him praise or someone is critical of him, thinks ill of him, then what happens? His whole outlook on life changes. He's ruined. He is depressed. He's discouraged. He goes with a cloud over his head. You almost as much as hear him say this to his wife and his friends when he says, I've been remarkably honored recently. I've been blessed in unbelievable ways. I mean, I've got more money than I know what to do with. I've got many sons. I've got a large family. I'm second in the kingdom only to the king himself. Do you know what? I'm miserable. Honey, I'm coming home from work today. I'm miserable. Why? Because there's this guy at work who doesn't think I hung the moon. He won't bow down and worship me. And I'm miserable. I don't care about all those other blessings I have. I don't care about all the good things that I have in my life because there's one man who doesn't acknowledge me, won't praise me. How sad it is when people allow their emotions to be controlled by the opinion of others. I say that very clearly to you because that happens all the time. Happens to Christians all the time. We let other people's opinion of us control our emotions entirely. And what's the basis of that? It's this issue right here. It's pride. The Christian is not to be like that. The Christian is to be happy based on a secure relationship that he has with the Lord Jesus Christ. The word happy is actually one of the translations of the Beatitudes when we have the word blessed. It's kind of a simple translation, I think, in one way, but there's some good connections there. Happy, it's to be in a blessed situation. Happy is the man who does such and such. Happy is the man who is such and such. Notice that individual in the Beatitudes is blessed. He's happy in all kinds of circumstances. When he's poor in spirit, he's happy. When he's meek, when he shows mercy, when he's pure in heart, when he's a peacemaker, and so on. You'll notice that pride isn't one of the things in the list there. Pride doesn't make one happy. It doesn't give you blessing. We started off with Psalm 40. Blessed is the man who makes the Lord his trust, not the one who seeks after pride. The verse we began with there. The man who makes the Lord his trust is blessed all the time. He's happy in the Lord. The man who is controlled by pride is discontent and never can make that happiness last, because there's always going to be something else that needs to be satiated. More praise. There are two more steps that the proud can fall into here in progressing away from God's plan and His path. And ultimately those plans, those other steps, continue to lead toward destruction. And I don't think we acknowledge that as much as we need to this morning, that pride in our heart leads to destruction. That's what the Lord says. If we have it in our heart, it's got to go. Because the next thing that happens to the proud man is that he begins to take immoral steps to uphold his pride. He takes immoral steps. What does Haman do in this story? I mean, if you step back and look at what he's doing. Chapter 3, verse 6. Chapter 5, verse 14. You see Haman, because of his pride, willing to do something outrageous. He's going to step outside of the lines of morality in order to satiate his pride. In chapter 3, he plots the murder of an entire race of people simply because one guy won't bow down to him. What? Pride has that kind of power, people. It does. Chapter 5, he builds a scaffolding 75 feet high to kill this guy and to do it publicly and to do so violently. No trial, no opportunity for defense. He just wants to go to the king and get this guy killed. That's all it's about. Now, really, am I being extreme here? Isn't pride... Pride doesn't really lead to murder, does it? Does it? Does it in your heart? Does pride lead to murder in your heart? What did God say back in that same passage that we were looking at earlier in Matthew? It certainly did, by the way, for Haman, didn't it? But is he just an extreme case? Going back to the Sermon on the Mount, here's what Jesus says. You have heard it said, do not murder. But I tell you that anyone who is angry with his brother will be subject to judgment. Angry with his brother. How many times has pride caused us to speak ill of our brother? Perhaps even call our brother a fool or an idiot. When that happens, Jesus says our pride has led to murder. If it's not murder, then there are other ways in which we break God's law in order to keep ourselves aloft on this pedestal of pride. The worse the pride, the greater the likelihood of our violating God's moral law, His good. Pride is a rejection of God as the Creator. It's a rejection of God as the Sustainer. Certainly as a rejection of Him as King. And it causes us to worship, as Romans 1 says, the creature rather than the Creator, ourselves. And then finally, what happens to this proud person as he continues down that path is he becomes all-consumed with self-promotion. All-consumed with self-promotion. Notice Haman in chapter 6, verse 4. Now, what's the context of chapter 6, verse 4? Look at this. We just read this. Verse 4 says, who is in the court? Now, Haman had just entered the court of the palace to speak to the king about hanging Mordecai on the gallows they had erected for him. What's the context of that? Haman has come and is now standing in the very court of the king, waiting for the first opportunity that he can get to speak to the king so that he can carry out this wicked plan of murdering a man, Mordecai. What time is it? What time is it in the story? Well, let's back up a little bit. The king had gone to bed in the evening. He'd been unable to sleep that night. He calls for something to occupy him and chooses the record of the chronicles of his reign. And in the reading of that, he learns of Mordecai's kind act that resulted in the king's life being spared. So Xerxes asks what has been done for this man who's saved my life. And his companions, his attendants say, well, nothing's been done for him. And then the king hears something in his ears. There's a man standing out there in the court. There's a man standing out in the court while he's not sleeping and he's having trouble with this. and he's having these things read to him, and he's wrestling with what ought to be done for this guy. The king ponders what ought to be done. And as he ponders, he hears in the court, someone's there. Who is it? Sure enough, it's Haman. What time is it? Doesn't say what hour, but I get you. The indication here is that it's early, early, early in the morning. The very first opportunity that Haman would have to speak to the king the next morning. The king has not slept all night. I want to suggest to you, Haman probably has not slept all night. Haman has been plotting. He wants the murder of this man. He's got to get it done because this guy doesn't praise me, you see. I am the one who has first, I want to be worshipped. I must kill that fool who doesn't honor me. I must get the king and make him see that this needs to happen. I will not rest until this man is dead. He's consumed with pride. It's eating him up. It won't let him sleep. And it has to be satiated. Those who don't think I'm to be praised have to be removed, you see. But Haman doesn't get to speak first. He's waiting there to get the opportunity to say to the king, here's a plan. I want you to give me permission to kill Mordecai. But he didn't get to speak first in God's providence. The king speaks first. And here's what he says. What should be done for the man the king delights to honor, Haman? What's the immediate reaction of Haman? Well, you won't be surprised now. We've built this up enough. Haman's a man consumed. Consumed with one thing. He's all consumed with one thing. And so, when the question comes, what should be done for the man the king delights to honor? Well, remember, he can't see reality. His eyes are clouded with proud, haughty eyes. So he says in verse 6, who is there? Who could there possibly be that the king would rather honor than me? Because I have such a lofty idea of myself. You see, it's all about me. Now, Haman is ugly here. He's pretty extreme. But that's what pride does in your heart. It says, it's all about me. And that's nonsense. It's wicked. Because there's a sovereign God, your Creator, who gave you gifts, who gives you abilities, who gives you life, gives you your very breath. To say it's all about me, in whatever small way we do that, is an affront to this sovereign God. We have to be careful about that. This man's heart is prideful. It's a perverted heart. It's a disillusioned heart. It's a blind heart. So watch your heart. What steps have you taken off of God's path of trust in God for your blessing? Jesus walked that very path that we are called to walk here. And we are called to have the same mind as Christ, who did not consider equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself. The NIV says he made himself nothing, taking the very nature of a servant. How did he do that? He emptied himself by taking on the form of a servant. The thing God hates most in this world is a prideful heart. He speaks again and again in the Scriptures about what he will do to those who have pride in their heart, to one who exalts himself and lifts himself up. Two examples. Let me give you two quick examples to make the point. Psalm 31, verse 23 says, "The Lord preserves the faithful, but abundantly repays the one who acts in pride." Abundantly so. Proverbs 16, 18, "Pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall." God will take down. He will take those down who are filled with pride. He will take them to destruction. And that's where God's sovereignty begins to clash with man's pride. We've talked about man's pride, particularly looking at Haman. But let's look at just for a minute about God's sovereignty. God created us, and sometimes we forget that we are no more than His creatures. Our self-centeredness and our pride ultimately denies that all we have and all we are is a gift from God. Three more verses. 1 Samuel 2:7. "The Lord makes poor and He makes rich. He brings low and He exalts." Matthew 23:12. "Whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and whoever humbles himself will be exalted." Proverbs 11:2. "When pride comes, then comes disgrace." Sort of the central idea here I want us to get across in our heads is that God cannot share His worship with His creation. And so it is that when man begins to claim a right to some of the praise, there's going to be a clash. And of course, God will win the clash. God will come out the victor. Notice a few things here about God and His sovereignty. First of all, He exalts the humble. That is a truth about this God that we worship. He exalts those who are humble. He doesn't forget the acts of obedience done by righteousness. Do you remember that we looked at Mordecai's act of obedience some time ago? That act, it was a tough act to do, I'm sure. When he probably had every reason to hate the king, he did good to his enemy. He did right to them. He saved his life, even though he really, kind of in a sense, probably in his heart, would like to have that king gone. But he did right there. And God remembers it. Mordecai, who had been just in dust and ashes the day before, by the end of this chapter here in 6, now wears the king's robe. He is seated on the king's horse. He is praised by his very enemy who wants to kill him. And of course, his life is spared. That's the repeated message to us. Proverbs 29, verse 23, one's pride will bring him low, but he who is lowly in spirit will obtain honor. I've probably quoted 15 verses already this morning on the same exact idea. Secondly, God orchestrates the smallest details of our lives in His sovereignty. Look at how God does this. And you need to remember this about your life, that God really works out every detail of your life. One night, God keeps the king from a restful sleep. Just any old night? No, it's not just any old night. It happens to be the night right before Mordecai is supposed to be put to death. It's not just any night. His enemy is planning to execute him in the morning. So it is that God will not let the king sleep. And during the night, the king has attendants read to him. Keep him busy. Let's give me something to think about other than trying the fact I can't sleep tonight. So he pulls out the Chronicles to have them read. But it's not just from any of the parts of the Chronicles. Eventually, we get to that part where Mordecai had saved the king's life. What a coincidence that the very night before he's supposed to be put to death, the king remembers the good deed that he had done and says, what should we do for this guy? God works out the timing so that the Haman, the man who wants to kill him, comes in and stands at the king's gate just as he's looking for what he can do to honor Mordecai. Oh, the irony. God turns Haman's plan upside down. God is the victor. There's been a clash, and God is the victor. Haman would honor himself. Haman would kill Mordecai. God would honor Mordecai, and God will kill Haman, destroy him, bring him to destruction. God works out the details. Third, we must humble ourselves. Really, this is the application. We have to humble ourselves, acknowledge God's sovereignty, and we must worship Him only. There's a clash between the sovereignty of our Creator and any kind of pride that we may have in our heart. Be aware that it's a part of the sure work of sanctification that He will wean you of it. You hear me? God will wean you of your pride. And so I want to say to you this. This God does in various ways, but believe me when I say to you that the easiest way it is for us to crucify that pride in ourselves in response to hearing God's Word. That's the easiest way. All the other ways of God weaning you of pride are not comfortable. They are not comfortable at best. It is no small thing to be humbled by God. And God does it if we don't do it. So humble yourself before the Lord. Follow Christ's step, who emptied himself and became a servant. May the destruction of the pride-filled Haman be a clear testimony to the reality of God's hatred of pride, and a call upon us to humble ourselves. May we learn to realize that this life is not all about us by any means. It's about Him. It's about His glory. We are put on the earth to bring Him glory. He is sovereign. He is the King. He's God. So let me conclude with this one quote I found from Tim Keller. We've read a couple of his books recently, who says, "A true humility is not thinking less of yourself. It's thinking of yourself less." If we go by that definition, then we need to think about other things. We need to seek first the kingdom. Seek it first. Put our eyes on there. Fix our eyes on Jesus. who will truly see the reality of His worth so that we might worship Him. And as the famous hymn says then, the things of the earth will grow strangely dim in the light of His glory and His grace. Let's think more of Him. Let's pray.